This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran dismisses Washington's accusations about endangering navigation in the Persian Gulf, saying the U.S. seeks to justify its meddlesome presence in the region. The Palestinian president calls on the international community to suspend Israel's membership in the U.N. as the world body commemorates the 75th anniversary of the Nakba. Also coming up, at least four people are killed in a shooting in the U.S. state of New Mexico as gun violence claims more lives across the country. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran has dismissed as baseless and utterly brazen U.S. allegations of endangering maritime security in the Persian Gulf region. Tehran says the U.S. seeks to justify its meddlesome presence in the region. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the allegations come as the U.S. has long been creating insecurity and instability in the Persian Gulf region. Nasser Kanani said Iran is the most effective guarantor of maritime security in the region and beyond. He stressed that it's the U.S. that has been threatening navigation freedoms and trade by illegally seizing Iran's oil consignments in international waters. Earlier this week, the White House said it will bolster the U.S.'s, quote, defensive posture in the Persian Gulf after accusing Iran of carrying out attacks on commercial shipping in the region. In recent weeks, Iran has seized two tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. One of the tankers collided with an Iranian vessel and tried to flee, while the other was subject to a legal complaint. The Palestinian Authority president has blamed the U.S. and the U.K. for the ongoing plight of the Palestinians. Mahmoud Abbas says it's up to the colonial states to bring the sufferings of the oppressed nation to an end. He made the remark at a U.N. event in New York marking the 75th anniversary of Nakba, or catastrophe. He said Washington and London took part in rendering the Palestinian people a victim when they decided to plant another entity in their lands for their own colonial goals. Abbas also demanded that Israel be suspended from the UN if it does not respect UN resolutions and grant Palestinians a state and the right of return for millions of refugees' descendants. This is the first time the UN is commemorating the Nakba Day. The General Assembly adopted a resolution in November 2022 to mark the occasion on May 15. Meanwhile, Palestinians and people around the world have rallied in the West Bank and elsewhere to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba.
The Zionist founder of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, said in 1949, everything must be done to ensure the Palestinians never return to their homes and villages. The old will die and the young will forget. However, the young Palestinians have not forgotten. Every year on May 15th, Palestinians commemorate Nakba Day, which remains at the heart of their national identity. Palestinians took to the streets across the occupied West Bank to commemorate 75 years of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime, with an estimated 760,000 Palestinians being expelled from their homes and villages. The Zionist goal was to make way for new Jewish immigrants to create what's known today as Israel, which Palestinians still insist it has no right to exist.
Inshallah, this is the last year of Nakba. It's enough. We want to return to our homes and villages. Our lands are still waiting for us. The Israelis tried to wipe off the Arab characteristics of the land, but our olive trees, our za'atar, are still there. Palestine, from the river to the sea, is ours.
Unfortunately, the scenario is repeated again and again. We commemorate this Nakba, but we hope we can commemorate the victory instead. It'll always remain as a catastrophe and a disaster. But I think that this oppression will end and be replaced by victory, inshallah. We're hoping that if not us, then our children will return back to our lands.
At 1 noon local time, a 75-second siren was sounded across the West Bank, marking the 75 years that have passed since the Nakba or the catastrophe. Demonstrators from all walks of life and of all ages held maps of historical Palestine and large metal keys to symbolize their homes from which they were forced to leave decades ago.
The Palestinians are still believing that they should continue. It's not a matter of a choice. It's an obligation for them to continue the way of struggle against the occupation and against all the consequences of the Nakba.
Nearly 5 million Palestinian refugees remain scattered in different camps in the besieged Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, Lebanon, Jordan and Syria, including others dispersed around the world. They all have a mutual dream, which is returning to historical Palestine. For Palestinians, the catastrophe of 1948, or Nakba, remains a painful episode in their history. Every day, the agony continues to be felt amid Israel's ongoing aggressive policies and its escalated violence and crimes. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In Canada's largest city, young Palestinians have taken the lead in remembering 75 years of resistance and the ongoing displacement and dispossession faced by Palestinians with the commemoration of Nakba Day in the streets of downtown Toronto.
The Zionists once upon a time said that the older generation will die and that the youth will forget. And we are here today proving not only that the youth will not forget, but that the youth will take up an active role in our people's struggle for national liberation. We believe that we have a responsibility to confront Zionism in our locales, wherever Zionism is.
Well, 75 years of occupation, 75 years of crimes against humanity. We're here to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And we want liberation. We believe that we are the generation of liberation.
Journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, murdered by Israeli troops 1 year ago, and political prisoner Kader Adnan were remembered among the numerous martyred and hundreds injured since the start of the year in historic Palestine amid an increase of violence by the Zionist occupation forces.
In the West Bank, we have seen continuous raids on cities like Jenin and Nablus, and these attempts have been to quell the youth that is rising up, resisting the settler colonial state that is taking away their rights and their right to live in dignity. We have seen home demolitions across historic Palestine in 48, in Al-Naqab, in Sheikh Jarrah. We have seen Palestinians being displaced. We have seen political prisoners succumb to their to medical negligence, a policy implemented by the Zionist entity intended to make sure that our political prisoners are effectively being slowly assassinated.
And so we are here saying that our prisoners carry the struggle forward and are our compass, that we will honor our martyrs and uphold their legacy. And we call on Palestinian youth and Arabs all across the world to play an active role in our struggle for national liberation.
Activists from a wide range of organizations are calling on Canadians to support Palestinian resistance by opposing Canada's contribution to Palestinian dispossession and joining the demand to end the illegal occupation. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
Moscow is no exception in commemorating Nakba Day. The ambassador of Palestine to Russia recalled the importance of Nakba so that the Palestinian cause remains alive in the memory of the Arab Islamic nation and the freedom-loving people of the world. Nakba Day designates as criminal the actions of those who provided funds and promises for the capture of Palestine from its people in the interests of the Zionist occupying entity, which committed and continues to commit the most heinous crimes against Palestinians.
I mean, today we are separating here and gathering here, I mean, to send a message for everybody that there's a right for Palestinian people. And we are need our rights. We need to live like others.
The participants assured that the Palestinians are unfailingly committed to their land and the establishment of a Palestinian state with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital.
Our Nakba, the memory of the catastrophe that befell the Palestinian people. We as Palestinians living in Russia mark this day here in Moscow every year. We call on all the free peoples of the world to stand in solidarity with our wounded people who are paying a huge price every day as a result of this occupation and encroachment on their property. The Palestinian people have lost their possessions, lost their land, and are now scattered, while there are those who claim that the land of Palestine is theirs. But we know this land will return to us Palestinians.
The double hypocrisy of the international community is that there is criminal responsibility in Europe for doubts about the persecution of Jews and the so-called Holocaust, then the fact that the Palestinians have become a nation without a homeland. Thousands have died and are dying. Hundreds of thousands have lost their homes. It's all the same. They don't notice it. It is important for Russia to demonstrate solidarity with the people of Palestine, because Russia is a country with soul, feeling the pain of others. To top it off, today the West has unleashed against Russia a piece of the repression that the Palestinians have been subjected for 75 years.
Nakba Day on May 15, 1948, was the fruit of many years during which the Zionist movement and the British plan to create an Israeli occupation entity and expel the indigenous inhabitants from their land.
On the anniversary of the Nakba Day, Moscow reiterated its readiness to continue its support for Palestinians aimed at achieving their legitimate rights and the establishment of their own free state. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The five-day Israeli aggression on Gaza has finally come to an end. Dozens of people, including women and children, were killed during the recent Israeli onslaught on the besieged coastal territory. Yet, the international community has failed to take any concrete measures against the Israeli regime for its atrocities against the Palestinians.
Gaza Strip, and yet again, another Israeli deadly aggression on the blockaded territory that finally ended following an Egypt-brokered truce on Saturday. The five-day onslaught claimed the lives of over 30 people, including women and children. The Palestinian fatalities included several Islamic Jihad commanders. Khalil al-Bahtini, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Azzeddin, a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, who also managed retaliatory operations in the West Bank and Gaza, and Jihad al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council, were all among those assassinated along with their families. A total of 51 Palestinian houses were completely destroyed, while about 1,000 others were damaged, prompting many people across Gaza to become homeless.
Now we are homeless, so we have no choice but to sleep on the street. Everything of us is ruined. I am worried about my children and other family members.
I demand compensation following this ceasefire because we are living on the streets now, no house or anything. My children and their children have no home. We are all left with nothing.
The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war in 2021. The carnage was to the extent which drew reaction from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza as unacceptable. The UN chief also called on the Israeli regime to immediately stop the bloodshed. Guterres said Israel must abide by its obligations under international humanitarian law, including proportionate use of force and taking all feasible precautions to spare civilians and civilian objects in the conduct of military operations. The UN chief also censured the Israeli closure of Gaza border crossings, which prevented the entry of foodstuff, medical supplies, and fuel into the besieged coastal territory.
Elsewhere, Syria has attended the preparatory session of the Arab League summit for the first time since its return to the organization. The delegation of Syrian officials was welcomed to the meeting held ahead of Friday's summit. Saudi King Salman has invited Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to participate in the summit that will be held in the port city of Jeddah. The invitation comes following an earlier meeting of the Arab League to readmit Damascus to the bloc. Member states have also welcomed the move, signaling tendency to resume relations with Syria. Damascus was suspended from the Arab League in November 2011 at the beginning of the foreign-backed militancy aimed at toppling the democratically elected government of President Bashar al-Assad. In other news, a shooting in the southwestern U.S. state of New Mexico has left four people dead, including the suspect. The incident took place in a residential area of the town of Farmington. Two officers were also wounded in the exchange of fire with the suspect. Police said there were multiple civilian victims, at least three of whom have died. The shooter was believed to have acted alone. So far, there is no detail on the reason behind the attack. The frequency of shooting incidents in the U.S. has increased significantly in recent years. This as politicians remain deadlocked on tighter gun control laws. That brings an end to world news for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
in the limelight.
French inflation is picking up pace. According to official data, food and energy are the main contributors to rising prices in France. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the website of RT, inflation in France accelerated in April, driven by a surge in energy prices. Data published by the National Statistics Bureau, INSEE, showed consumer prices rose by 5.9% last month on an annual basis, up from 5.7% in March. The new figures has revealed energy price growth soared to 6.8% in April after a 4.9% increase in March, mainly due to rising fuel costs. Meanwhile, the increase in gas prices eased from the March reading of 35.6%, coming in at 22.9% higher year on year in April. Food prices climbed 15% year-on-year, slightly lower than the March reading of 15.9%. The downtick was attributable to a seasonal decline in the prices of fresh goods. However, despite this lower pace of price growth, INSEE economists said soaring food costs have had a more significant impact on overall inflation than rising energy costs. Also, a recent survey by market research firm Ilabe showed that 43% of French consumers have cut back on buying certain food items due to inflation. Among those surveyed, 43% reported having cut down on meat, 34% were buying less fish, and 27% had given up cakes and biscuits. According to the survey, most French consumers have had to adjust their shopping habits, with 44% opting for cheaper food and 30% now buying smaller quantities. French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire said in March that he expected inflation to peak this summer and then start to ease. Bank of France Governor François Villori de Gallo acknowledged that inflation across the Eurozone remains too high and continues to be the main concern and top priority for monetary policy. In March, the French authorities introduced a so-called anti-inflation food basket, comprising about 50 basic items, and obliged large retailers not to hike prices on these staples until June. Meanwhile, according to recent reports, the French government is planning to increase enforcement of taxation controls and to toughen penalties for tax evasions, with a fresh focus on combating major fraud, according to the Minister of Public Action and Accounts, Gabriel Attal. The minister noted that the number of inspections of the country's biggest businesses would be increased by 25% by the end of the second presidential term of Emmanuel Macron in 2027. According to Attal, the efforts would be focused on the high end of the spectrum, on the biggest scams, the most complex ones, those that often have international involvement. If you are planning to pile pressure on the super rich and the multinationals, thus alleviating the pressure on the middle classes and small business owners, he told France Interradio recently, adding, "There is an overwhelming majority of French who work and pay taxes who are victims of this fraud." Et al. Also highlighted the necessity to alleviate the pressure on the small taxpayers by simplifying the system of declaration and by establishing an automatic penalty waiver for the first error. He also pledged to create an automatic reverse of penalty in favor of a taxpayer in the event of an error by the government. As part of the plan, the country's authorities are expected to conduct tax audits of the 100 largest companies on the stock market every other year, as no specific frequency of such inspections has been established for French corporate majors. The ministry is planning to hire 1,500 additional employees to carry out the more numerous tax audits by 2027. Moreover, a new tax intelligence service is to be set up under the Ministry of Economy and Finance, with 100 elite agents to be hired in the fight against major tax fraud at international level. According to the latest data provided by French authorities, anti-tax fraud measures have helped to claim a return of 14.6 billion euros, almost $16 billion to the Treasury, an increase of 8.2% compared to 2021.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us ponder on this brief but beautiful piece of advice from Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, the sixth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Sleep little at night and speak little during the day. The less thankful organs are the eye and the tongue. Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, "If you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous."
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to get rid of suffering from idleness. In the name of God, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful, may His peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and His pure immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salaamu Alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to be with you in this program. We're going to start our program today with a very, very important question. That is, must youth suffer from idleness, which is a source of corruption and boredom? So what is the way to get out of this impasse? To answer this question, the case, this very special case, in its first point is connected with the economic state of the countries, and this is not in our hand. But as the remaining points, they are connected with the culture of the youth in this concern, I would say that everything can be subjected to man's will if he only knows how to do that. Second, the youth have to create opportunities to work by themselves to the extent that the law will permit them. This requires them to be acquainted with the law. And third, the youth have to reject laziness, extra sleeping, and living based on their desires. And four, they have to know the disadvantages of idleness and leisure, for they bring man meanness and cause him to become involved in unlawful things and lead him to fail in life. So this is very important to have these principles that we can gain them from Quran and Hadiths in our mind, and also, you know, if we want to get rid of them, inshallah. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, an Islamic lifestyle, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. So we were talking about the cultural reasons that makes us feel odorless and meanless, that is a source of corruption in the life. And we counted four of them, and we're going through the rest. So number five, if we are going to mention about this reason, is that a young man should know that life is a responsibility. First, he should be responsible for himself and then for his close relatives. So we have to understand that life is responsibility itself. And very, very firstly, we are responsible for our life, and our youth are responsible for themselves. Number six, a man should be humble and not disdain to accept a lawful job with the excuse that this is an ordinary job and it does not befit my or his position or rank. Many other people who have become wealthy whereas they were poor at the beginning of their lives, and many other people who have become presidents or high chiefs whereas their beginnings were simple. And number seven, creativity is a quality of successful people. Let the youth try to create jobs by which they will be prosperous and live well. And the last one, thinking, reading, activeness, joyful spirit, optimism, satisfaction, supplication and praying are among the main qualities that prepare for opportunities of work, and then free time will be occupied and idleness will be treated, inshallah. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Immersion in the virtual world.
Part 2.
Searing graphic images, a cool and immersive universe where you are the hero. It's far from Mom and Dad's Pong, Tetris, and Super Mario. But today's video games are also about money. Lots of money. An industry that racks up $83 billion a year, according to some financial experts. That's more than the movies. To sell, what works is often used and abused. Sex, and especially violence. It stands out in big box stores. The most numerous and visible games are not recommended if you are under 18 years old. In the world of psychopaths or even soldiers, the idea is to lick the enemy. A vicious circle that is not always easy to escape. Mike is 19 years old with Swiss and American citizenship. He was immersed in FPS video games at a young age, first-person shooter games.
I've played games ever since I was a kid, really, with my friends, by myself, with my family, always. Back then, it was just, you know, a hobby that I would do for fun and something that, you know, a common hobby that I would share with my friends. But then eventually, it started getting to the point where I was depending on it emotionally.
Hours after the massacre, the New York journalist Matthew Lisiak was sent on site. He investigated Newtown for nearly 5 months.
In telling this story, it's not to glorify a killer. It's to try to understand why this happened. Because if we stop trying to really figure out why these things happen, we give up the future to the next killer. And I have four daughters. You know, I'm not prepared to let that happen.
Why does this massacre also interest us? Police quickly made a stunning discovery in the Lanz's home. Bedroom windows covered with black plastic bags, a den full of arms and ammunition, but also computer screens, computer consoles, and video games.
There were things that we found in the literature review. We had people, we contacted scholars who were well known in the field, asked them to send us recent studies we may not know or anything they thought that we should be aware of. And we just accumulated all of them and sorted through them all and scored them and read them and spent a lot of time evaluating them.
Dozens of studies from around the world. The most recent we could find. The very best of science in this field. The result?
The findings that we had were pretty consistent overall. We got an effect for overall aggression, so just everything, a composite score. Then we got effects for aggressive behavior, for thinking about aggression, for being roused by playing with aggressive video game content, for being desensitized to it, for being less empathic, less prosocial. So just an array of different findings that came out very consistently.
No proof that violent video games make you a killer, but there is a but. Contrary to what many people think, they don't curb your frustrations.
That's wishful thinking, that you get your aggressive feelings out by playing games, because we find people get more aroused, not less aroused, and that they're thinking about aggression and they're acting aggressively and they're less empathic and they're less prosocial. So they're not draining off aggressive impulses. That's just not happening by game playing in terms of anything that we saw in the data.
These scientific conclusions are shared by numerous experts in Switzerland too, and even players notice it. Not easy to remain calm in certain online games when the goal is to shoot others dead. More complicated, however, is recognizing that this violence also affects oneself.
I think people don't want to believe that it has an effect on them, but it does. I mean, if you look at the data and if you look at the studies, there are consistent and persistent effects of using violent video games on a number of dimensions of human functioning. The science is the science. The data speak for themselves, and we looked at the data very carefully across large numbers of studies. So I think that was part of why we are convinced that it is a risk factor. But it's not going to affect everybody in the same way, and that's probably why some people say, well, it didn't affect me at all.
To reach all its conclusions, the American meta-analysis integrates many lab tests, like these conducted in Grenoble. This experiment compares the level of aggressiveness between two players without them knowing it. One plays a game that is brutal, the other a sports game, for example. Researchers analyzed the heartbeat, measuring the intent to hurt the other by inflicting sound shocks and evaluating the aggressive thoughts of each player. Again, it's very clear. Violent content increases aggressiveness. In a nutshell, the more you kill virtually, the more real harm done. And a video game is not exactly a movie, according to this professor of social psychology. Return to Switzerland in the canton of Bern. A little tour in this ordinary school courtyard where we quickly understand that our little darlings don't just play pacifist games, quite the contrary. Roland Naev has been working in this school for 30 years and elected socialist for 20 years. For him, reality and fiction are increasingly intertwined. And he is convinced in certain cases that virtual violence may even lead to taking action. Some players will cry scandal. Taking action is obviously a point that makes for polemics. And rightly so, it's difficult to have scientific proof. The desire to know more sent us back to Connecticut. 4 years after the massacre, we went to Sandy Hook. With this question in the firing line, why? What's striking coming here is the apparent calm and the willingness to forget this fatal December the 14th, 2012. Newtown's rich neighborhoods, the home of the young gunman was totally razed. 5 kilometers from there, the elementary school too. The bricks were pulverized to leave no trace. A new school is still under construction.
Another friend referred to Adam as a shut-in. His mental health issues, combined with his military ambitions, his gaming habit, and a dramatic decline in any form of social interaction had caused the young man to withdraw further and further from reality. Even the shooting range was barely appealing. The months leading up to the shooting, he almost spoke to nobody. He just stayed in his room, playing violent video games, occasionally would go to the mall where he would play Dance Dance Revolution, hours out, hours on end. And he was plotting this, but he was kind of falling further and further into a state of what experts refer to as psychosis, She's just like, the connection he had with reality, which we all have when largely from interactions, we talk to other people. He had none of that. There were no lines. He wouldn't even talk to his mom towards the end. Completely cut her off. So his mom would communicate with Adam through emails.
An evil plunge into the virtual, confirmed by experts from the Child Protective Services of Connecticut.
I mean, I think it was the sense of everybody who looked at the documents that we looked at, conversations with the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit, a debriefing by them, absolutely living in this parallel universe was extraordinarily unhealthy.
Her office had access to the young killer's medical report, to his academic records, and also to the confidential reports of the police and the FBI. It also comes to light that Adam Lanza had dangerous predispositions.
Certainly there is a sense he was on the autism spectrum disorder. There's a larger sense that he had very significant interfering obsessive compulsive disorder, not a kind of global interest, but only things that he wanted to learn about. And there was enormous acquiescence on his family's part to that. Not sort of pushing him or, you know, trying to get him to expand his horizons or, in fact, seek significant treatment as he became more and more and more isolated and withdrawn to then seek some help for him.
But was he a violent kid?
There was nothing that we saw in his record to indicate that he was a violent child.
Isolation, addiction to violent video games, mental vulnerability, poor parental support. The eye of a storm capable of destroying everything in its path due to one last risk factor. In this case, easy access to weapons.
And here's a boy that's not going out and doing anything but has access to an arsenal of weapons in his home because it's the thing he expressed interest in. And that's part of the parental appeasement. Oh, that's what you're interested in? That's the only thing you're interested in? Okay, we'll buy you more of those. That's not what he needed. He needed mental health treatment. He needed friends. He needed relationships. He needed his father. He needed his brother. And he didn't have any of that in his life anymore.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Uncertainty about the U.S. government's debt ceiling of $31.4 billion has added to global economic concerns. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, has warned that there is a very high risk of default in the first 2 weeks of June, when the U.S. government is likely to run out of money and to default on its debts. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has covered this story and tells us more. The Washington standoff over raising of the U.S. government's $31.4 trillion borrowing limit is adding to global economic worries, as a new nonpartisan congressional report cited a significant risk of a historic default within the first 2 weeks of June. The U.S. Congressional Budget Office, the CBO report issued on Friday morning, 12th of May, confirms Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's earlier warnings that a default could come as early as 1st of June. The Congressional Budget Office warned there is significant risk that at some point in the first 2 weeks of June, the government will no longer be able to pay all of its obligations. Congress Budget Scorekeeper also noted that the federal government's debt payments will remain uncertain throughout May, even if the Treasury ultimately runs out of funds in early June. President Joe Biden and his Democratic colleagues in Congress have urged prompt action to raise the $31.4 trillion statutory limit on government borrowing without conditions since the beginning of the year. Republicans, who narrowly control the House of Representatives, want new limits on future spending nailed down before they give the green light on more payments to cover borrowings on previously enacted spending. At a meeting of the Group of Seven finance ministers in Japan, World Bank President David Malpass said the looming risk of a default, which would be the first in U.S. history, was adding to problems facing the slowing global economy. David Malpass told Reuters news agency on the sidelines of the G7 finance ministers' meeting, "Clearly, distress in the world's biggest economy would be negative for everyone." In the coming days, President Biden is scheduled to attend the G7 leaders' meeting in Niigata, Japan, but recently said he could cancel his trip if he and congressional leaders were not making enough progress towards a debt limit increase. A meeting between President Biden and Democratic and Republican congressional leaders that had been tentatively planned for Friday, 12th of May, was postponed as both sides haggle over what spending could be cut in the 2024 budget. The standoff was starting to show its effect outside of Washington. On Friday, the University of Michigan reported its twice-monthly reading of consumer sentiment showed households have the bleakest view of the economy in the past 6 months, in no small part thanks to the debt ceiling showdown. Survey director Joanne Hsu said in a statement, "Year-ahead expectations for the economy plummeted 23% from last month." The U.S. newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. Wall Street, too, has been fretting over a potential debt default. U.S. stocks fell after the sentiment data showed households growing concerns about the situation, while yields on Treasury securities maturing in the first half of June remain significantly elevated relative to later maturing debt. While staffs toiled behind closed doors, lawmakers blamed each other for the turmoil. Referring to former President Donald Trump's Make America Great Again movement, Joe Biden said, "MAGA House Republicans are threatening to default on America's debt unless we give in to their demands." Biden warned that Republicans may cut funding for thousands of jobs, including national park rangers and firefighters. Republican Representative Anthony Desposito tweeted back to President Biden. He said, "Mr. President, stop lying," claiming the president was refusing to negotiate with Republicans in good faith. Biden and his cabinet have said repeatedly a default would be catastrophic. They warn U.S. bonds are the foundation of the global financial system, and a default would rattle global markets and could trigger a recession. On the sidelines of the G7 finance ministers' meeting in Japan, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Wall Street leaders and business owners to speak out about
how the fight over the debt limit was affecting economies and causing a grave level of uncertainty. Janet Yellen intends to discuss the current impasse in the coming days with leading bankers. A senior Treasury official said she would do that with board members of the Bank Policy Institute lobby group. With the battle in Washington dragging on, one House Democrat floated an idea that might get lawmakers' attention. Democratic Representative Abigail Spanberger said members of the U.S. Congress ought to have their paychecks withheld until the debt limit problem is resolved. Congress has raised the debt limit to roughly $31.4 trillion in late 2021, but not without months of drama between both sides of the aisle as Republicans tried to use the task as a leverage point to secure concessions from Democrats, who instead pushed for a clean increase with no preconditions. Congress finds itself in similar terrain yet again, as a GOP-led House vows not to raise the debt ceiling unless Democrats agree to significant spending cuts. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. Analysts have warned homeowners could see mortgage rates rocket to 8.4% if the US defaults on its debt, after they fell to 6.35% in recent days. US President Joe Biden has less than 1 month to stop the country defaulting for the first time in history after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned the government may not be able to pay its bills by 1st of June. If a solution is not reached, households face fiscal chaos, which could cause 7 million jobs to be lost and investment to plummet. Experts from property website Zillow have estimated that such an outcome could cause mortgage rates to soar as high as 8.4% by September. Zillow warned this would push up the cost of an average mortgage repayment by 22%. Recent figures from lender Freddie Mac showed that the average rate on a fixed-rate 30-year mortgage was now 6.35%, down from 6.39% a week earlier. Jeff Tucker, a senior economist at Zillow, said home buyers and home sellers finally have been adjusting to mortgage rates over 6% this spring, but a debt default could potentially raise borrowing costs even higher and send the market into a deep freeze. Jeff Tucker added, home values might not see a notable drop, but higher mortgage rates would severely impair affordability, for first-time buyers especially. He added, it was critically important that lawmakers found a solution before a default occurs. On Monday, 8th of May, President Biden went toe-to-toe with Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy in their first meeting in over 3 months. The two men are entrenched in opposing views as President Biden wants to raise the debt ceiling to stop a default. However, Kevin McCarthy has insisted the measure will not pass through Congress. President Biden is now considering using the 14th Amendment to push through an increase to the debt ceiling, though he expressed reservations about doing so. The 14th Amendment says the validity of the public debt authorized by law shall not be questioned.